All right. Well, today is August 13th, and the topic that we have today is refugees and mission. Okay, and this is a little bit of a large and daunting task. So let's see where we go from there. My wife told me not to include this slide, but I just had to do it. The refugee crisis. Somewhere, somehow, somebody must have kicked you around some. And it was named Tom Petty, and my wife was like, you can't put philosopher after him. But you may have heard the song, Refugee, and this is the line, somewhere, somehow, somebody must have kicked you around some. Unfortunately, the song goes on to say that you don't have to live like a refugee, and unfortunately, that's not the case. The people that we're talking about today are not refugees by choice, nor inclination, and nor can they just make a decision not to live as a refugee. But it just amused me, so I had to include the line there. If you could, let's turn to Psalm 107, and we can start there. And I'll read the first nine verses of that. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble and gathered in from the lands, from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south. Some wandered in desert wastes, finding no way to a city to dwell in. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted within them. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He led them by a straight way till they reached a city to dwell in. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of man. For he satisfies the longing soul, and the hungry soul he fills with good things. It was just so powerful in the message today to listen to the pastor, to Chris, talk about just observing what he did in India, and Sean could certainly speak more to it, of just seeing these needs and just be thinking right away, this is not right that people would be living like this, and just their physical needs and just the overwhelming weight that comes with individuals that would be living in such poverty and in such slums, and yet their greatest need is not spiritual. I mean, it is spiritual. It is not physical. And so while we are going to be looking at this and confronting with just the human suffering and just how widespread and devastating it is, we need to remember that their greatest need is spiritual, and that we earnestly want to seek to meet their physical needs. And that certainly can be a way of entry and approach and going forward. But we need to always remember that no matter how impoverished they are on a human level, that it is their spiritual needs that are the greatest. And as we think of that, let's just go forward. I've got the definition of a refugee. I pulled this off of the UN Refugees site. It is a refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Most likely, they cannot return home or are afraid to do so. War and ethnic, tribal, and religious violence are leading causes of refugees fleeing their countries. All right. Uh-huh.
Italy's migrant crisis is spiraling beyond control. Rescues like this are now daily events in the Mediterranean. 7,000 people were brought ashore over the weekend. More than 90,000 have made it here from North Africa this year. Holding centres are swelling fast. This old NATO missile base near Venice was opened 2 years ago to house just 50 people. Now, more than 1,500 live here.
I'm from ITV, British Television. Can we come in?
Here's what they don't want you to see. These pictures were given to us by some of the people who live here. They show vast tents crammed with migrants and refugees. Their metal box wedged in, just inches apart. Blankets hanging from the bed frames, offer the only privacy. They told us they're given just 3 bowls of rice per day to eat. Yet we've learned the charity that set up the camp gets more than £1 million per month from the Italian government to run it. £12 million a year for this. Outside the gates, we tried to speak to some residents, but a security guard was soon on hand to warn them off. They've been told there will be consequences for anyone who talks to the press. But these men did agree to meet us.
I think when I come to this place, life will be very okay for me. Nothing is driving my heart out of the country. I just want to live a civilized world, number one.
Inside the camp is terrible. I've not, even in my country, Nigeria, I've not lived a life like this. You understand? I was told that Europe is a good place, but I came here to see that I'm under the canopy.
Italy was already in dire financial trouble before these problems began. Now, it's sinking ever deeper into debt as it tries to cope with all these new arrivals. The only real help the EU is offering is the opportunity to quietly borrow yet more money. So with another Mediterranean crisis now in full swing, this country feels as if it's been cast adrift. You drive past, look, and forget about us, this banner says. In his office in Rome, Italy's deputy foreign minister told me if other countries don't start pulling their weight, this pressure could see the EU fall apart.
It's not an Italian threat or an Italian menace to the EU, but it's reality.
It could break up.
Yeah, and if we want to preserve EU future, we need covert effort.
It is a warning and a stark one. Geography may have handed Italy this crisis, but it can't bear the burden alone. Martin Geisler, ITV News, Con Ita, Italy.
Okay. So I think in that video, you know, we're seeing a little bit of just the human cost and the toll that is being brought forth. Not only that there is such a human cost in these countries that these individuals are fleeing from, but just a human cost. Oh, excuse me. Okay, so. Here's a slide. It may be difficult to see, so here I'm going to point it out to you. This map right here is a map of Europe. It's having some of these. It's having the areas of which the migrants are entering Europe. You see that there's the largest area is coming across Turkey from Syria. It's going into Greece and the Balkans, and then coming up into Europe. And then there's also a route that is crossing from sea from Libya and Tunisia over into Italy. And then there seems to be one that's coming more and more prevalent is they're starting to cross over from North Africa into Spain as well. I just saw a video of a boat. Had a boat of about 50 people just disembark and jump off of the boat and run up this beach surrounded by Spanish beachgoers in swimming suits, bikinis, and the like, and you have this boat just arrive on the shore and they jumped off. There seemed to be a little bit of dissonance between what was going on the beach there, and so then these are the countries that are where they're going and seeking asylum. Germany is by far the largest as listed on this map. This, I think, was about a year old, this map, but it's It's just fascinating to watch. I mean, the refugee situation seems to be changing almost daily as routes change, as countries close particular camps or routes it just seems to be very fluid. And not only are there these pressures from the countries that they're coming from, but you heard the Italian deputy foreign minister speak of it could cause a devastation of the EU. I mean, this is in the aftermath of the United Kingdom deciding to leave the EU, but it's also causing tensions between member states, particularly places like Germany, as they took in a huge influx of individuals. Well, it was swamping their countries that the individuals were passing through. So this just has a powerful, this is just having repercussions just across the world. And the countries that these refugees are pouring into, Italy and Greece and Spain, these are already countries that have been weak and economically suffering. And there's already been a great deal of tension between them and the northern European countries that are far richer. And you may remember the Greek economic crisis. Well, that was occurring before thousands of these refugees are flooding across their borders and taking up further resources. So it's just, it's history before our eyes. How is this going to affect not only the countries where they're flooding from, but how is this going to change Europe culturally, demographically, just nation states as a whole? What is going to happen as a result of these refugees? And as this history is being made, certainly the church is going to be called, and how is the church going to respond in light of this situation? Okay, sorry, I'm not real great at this, but so you probably can't read these slides, but this one right here is a total monthly arrivals in the European Union, and this was showing in 2014, 15, and 16. In the month of October, there was approximately 225,000 refugees into the EU in that 1 month, coming over by land or by boat. You could see that it dropped off quite a bit into January and February of March of 2016. That's the one in gray. It's interesting to see a little bit of the parallels between this and the Book of Acts. You know, you have the story of Paul and how the ship needed to winter over because of the Mediterranean seas, and they couldn't travel in the winter, and they were having to find a safe harbor before that. It's not that the months of January, February, March of 2016 that the problem has been reduced from October of 2015. Rather, it's the weather and the danger of crossing over at that time of the year. Okay. Sea arrivals in Greece and Italy. You have that figure. Sea arrivals October 2015, over 200,000, primarily in Greece, but then also in Italy as well. And 200,000 people coming in 1 month would probably be a hiccup for a country our size and with 300 million plus. But in a small country like Greece or Italy, that's just incredible. Also, this just shows a little bit where are these refugees flooding into Greece and Italy and then the rest of the EU from. If you look at Greece, this light green, that is Syria. So well over half are from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan. Those are other ones. So more middle central Asia. Italy reflects more of an African focus. Eritrea, it appears to be about number one. So Eritrea, that's on the Horn of Africa, the point there on the right. And so other countries one of the other larger ones is Somalia, that's also there on the Horn of Africa. Nigeria, Gambia, Senegal, Mali, these are other countries. And then there are some coming from Syria as well. And so these are just, they're coming from all over. and they are flooding these nations.
Those are really long. Some of those journeys are quite long, just to get from where you're just mentioning to even get up to Italy and Greece, right? I mean, so they have a tumultuous journey just to even get where they end up getting.
Yeah, I mean, imagine going from Afghanistan, I mean, crossing over through, I guess it's shrunk now, but ISIS territories and just going into Turkey, and you know, there's the far east part of Turkey has the Kurdistan lands, and there's hostility there between the Turks. I mean, you're crossing through war zones and other hazardous situations just to get there. And then I'll read this one off to you. And this comes with a cost, in that 2015 documented over 3,500 people, migrant refugee deaths at sea. I would say, just by its very nature, how do you accurately document how many people are lost at sea? I mean, you don't have registers of people boarding onto these unseaworthy craft to cross over. I mean, I'm sure the figure is quite higher than that. That would just be the figures of what they are aware of. So the scale and of the human suffering is vast. And Europe is getting the focus of this. Europe is the one of which most people's attention is at. But this is not a problem that is just limited to Europe. One place that has not received attention is the country of Uganda. At the moment, Uganda is having perhaps the greatest influx of refugees in the world, and you may not even have heard of that. It says here on this headline, this is on the Australian Broadcasting News, Uganda's refugee intake dwarfs European countries as South Sudan crisis worsens. And Uganda has been actually very generous in opening its borders to refugees, but as they're coming from there and the Central African Republic. But just some facts. In the past 12 months, the Central African nation has taken in about 1.3 million people. Okay, Uganda is about the size of the state of Oregon. So I think Oregon has maybe 3-4 million people. Uganda already has about 35 million people. They say by the year 2050 that it's going to have over 100 million people in a country the size of Oregon. And then it is taking in these large influxes of immigrants as well. The pressures that are being faced. Every day, 2,000 people stream across Uganda's borders, fleeing famine, drought, and violence in neighboring countries. Okay. So just amazing, the sorts of figures. They talked about one of these camps holding 250,000 individuals.
They don't have health care, they don't have anything, they barely even have food.
Yeah, they're suffering from food and food shortages, but in situations like this, I mean, you can tell this is not the most, this is not green like Tennessee. This is not profitable land, and they're being forced to live when large peoples are gathered together in situations such as this is temporary housing, food or lack of food doesn't become the number one issue. The number one issue becomes water and the diseases that are associated with the lack of clean water. Okay, here's some facts. Approximately 15 million refugees in the world today. And that figure, you got to take this into account. When they're talking about refugees, they typically are talking about people who have left their own country and had to flee to some other country. Okay, displaced people may be those who are still within the borders of their own country. They can be called internally displaced. So displaced would include both those internally displaced, but then also those who have refugees and fled their country. The figure is something more like 65 million people. Okay, approximately 1% of those will get to leave a camp per year. I've heard this figure, don't take it, I've heard some questions regarding it, but these camps, some people have estimated it can be as long as 15, 20 years that people are in. They're in these for a long time. You know, what we call Palestinian refugee camps, I mean, those have been in existence since 1948, some of them. 80% of all, and this was an interesting one. I pulled this off of Global Frontier Missions. This was a sad thing, and as we're going to start getting into the call upon the church, 80% of all resettled refugees in the United States are never invited into an American home. So they're cast adrift there in their lands, and then they're deposited in a foreign culture, and we do little to integrate them in with us.
So, I worked with a refugee ministry, Catholic Charities in Nashville, and so I helped like get them settled into a place. So it was interesting, just like, you know, helping them get their work and like just hearing their stories of how they even got here and how they had to leave people and to even get here. Like they had to have so many. I don't remember the process exactly of how they got listed under the refugee status, but then. Even they had to, like Catholic Charities helped cover their travel costs, but they had to pay it back once they got a job and that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
I think so, something like that. But they, like flying costs and that kind of thing.
You're fortunate you didn't tell me this earlier. I might have had you teach. So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I had a really busy week this week, and into Friday, I'd been in court most of the day. I got back to the office, and we refer to it as court brain. You know, we can't do any higher thought at that point. And so, I'm sitting around, and I just start talking to a couple of my coworkers. One is of Cambodian descent. Her parents were in the camps in Thailand. And her sister was actually born in one of the refugee camps. And the other guy in the conversation, his family was Dutch Jewish, and he lost large amounts of family members in the Holocaust. So it's interesting to just even be thinking of, you know, just colleagues have these family histories of displaced people and the trauma that was suffered. My Cambodian coworker, well, I mean, she's American. She was born in the U.S., but... she talked about watching the movie The Killing Fields. I don't know if you've seen that, but about that experience. And she was watching it on her laptop and in her room, and her mother coming in and sitting down and suddenly seeing what the movie was and just her sobbing so much that this daughter had to quickly shut the laptop and couldn't handle it. I mean, these people deal with, I mean, that's 40 years ago. That's 40 years ago that she went through that, and that still has just a powerful impact. She says her father has never talked about it. Her mother has told her stories of being held in a underground for months on end and coming out and being blind due to the lack of inability to see light. And I mean, these stories are all over. These stories are all over. And how can we respond and be faithful in the midst of them? And the Cambodians, in the Cambodian issue, there actually was a powerful coming to faith in those refugee camps in the years during and then after the Khmer Rouge had taken over that country, and many came to Christ. And so the church was faithful, and it responded. And in the midst of these people's suffering and tragedy, there was much hope, and the gospel went forth. And so it's happened before, and it certainly can happen again. And it needs to be something that we're praying about and seeking to go forward with. So places that they flee from, going to hotspots at the moment. Syria is one. Central African Republic is another. South Sudan are places where they're fleeing. The Horn of Africa, Eritrea, Somalia, and then Central America. This may be one that catches some of you by surprise, but the countries of Honduras, I think it's Honduras, Guatemala, and Costa Rica, I think are plagued by gang violence at the moment, and many are fleeing. You may recall a few years ago when so many young boys and girls were coming into the U.S. and were being detained. They were making the trip all the way through Mexico, trying to flee the gang violence that was going on in those countries. And so it's not just Europe. It's not just those coming from Syria and trying to flee into Europe, but it is happening on almost every continent. And routes of safety, those may be Uganda, the Libya to Italy trip. Another route is that Turkey into the Balkans and then into Central and Western Europe. And so these are places in which they are seeking to flood. Okay. Why then does this matter? I mean, you could go and you could watch the news and you could basically get this account. Why is this so important? Well, because obviously it's important to God. This book is replete. It is, in much of its story, it is an account of refugees. We have Adam and Eve being cast out of the garden, being sent, and the angel being standing there east of Eden. They had a land that they were not to return to. So from the very beginning, this book tells of Adam and Eve being refugees. Cain is cast away as soon as after his fratricide. Jacob and his sons going down to Egypt. The account of Exodus is one of refugees and seeking the promised land. Naomi. And her family going, and that's a case of they were actually sinful in going. That had been the land that they had been promised, and they went to a land of the Gentiles in order to escape circumstances within their land. But that is a story of refugees. David certainly being on the run and cast aside and having to leave for political reasons. We have Joseph, Mary, and Jesus traveling down to Egypt. The Jerusalem church. And it's just, if you want to turn there, turn to Acts. I never really thought of this before, but... we talk of Paul being so crucial, being an apostle to the Gentiles and being so crucial for the spread of the church. But there in after chapter 7, Stephen has been stoned. It says in 8, Saul approved of his execution, and there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And furthermore, he's going to persecute further. Paul was already a means by which the gospel was being spread. Before his conversion, he was one of the agents and the tools of the gospel going forth by the very scattering of the people to Antioch and Damascus and places such as that. Another refugees, Aquila and Priscilla, they are cast out of the city of Rome, and Paul comes and meets with them. Claudius had kicked the Jews out of Rome. They would be allowed to return to the city a few years later, but they were refugees at that time as well. Not only are they the accounts there of the refugees, but here are some of the verses that God is speaking to God's heart for the refugees. Exodus 23:9. You shall not oppress a sojourner. you know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Throughout, God is calling the Israelites to recall their past, to recall their past as sojourners, as refugees, to take care of those within their midst who are foreigners, and to show them mercy. Deuteronomy 10 says much the same thing, or speaks to the character of God. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves a sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you are sojourners in Egypt. And then and then Hebrews 11, that great chapter of faith. We have that initial half of the chapter that is just so powerful and so inspiring, as we hear these great heroes of the faith who seem to conquer so much in God's name, and then we get to the rest of them. So some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and caves of the earth. And then we have the charge in Matthew 20:29, Jesus in speaking with his apostles. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake will receive 100-fold and will inherit eternal life. The words of being sojourners are not just to those who are in the Bible, but then those who are faithful and followers of Christ beyond. 1 Peter 2:11, Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Those are some of the verses that we have speaking to our status as sojourners and those of us who are not citizens of this world, but then to speaking to the Israelites as well and those in those accounts. Christians throughout history have often been faithful in the midst of these circumstances, and the gospel has gone forth. Augustine lived in a very interesting time. He was about late 4th century, early 5th century. And during his time occurred the sack of Rome. And he was located in North Africa as a bishop at that time. He had been up in Italy for a period, and he'd actually come to faith in the city of Milan. And this was during the fall of the Roman Empire. And with that came large floods of refugees from Italy down to North Africa, and his sermons speak of their care, charging his church to care for the refugees that came from Italy, that came from Rome. And actually, as occurs in situations like this, the questions arise, right? Where is God? How has he allowed this? What has gone forth from here? Where do we go from here? And many of the people actually attributed the fall of the Roman Empire in the West to the adoption of Christianity. That's a view that's lasted all the way until Gibbons wrote the book, The Fall and Decline of the Roman Empire, and he makes that very charge that the Roman Empire fell because of the adoption of Christianity. Augustine then writes his book, City of God, in response to that, speaking of there being a city of man and a city of God, and the citizenship of believers in the city of God, and having their hope in that city of God rather than the city of man, rather than in empires and powers that be. So This is not a new question. This is not a new question. You can imagine that after 400 years of empire and several hundred years of republic before that, the permanence that people thought of the Roman Empire and just it was their very basis of existence, and there it's falling in a swoop. Where does that leave? Where does that leave people? And Augustine was faithful in ministering to those refugees and writing a response of and just an understanding of God's work in the midst of these circumstances. Gladys Allward, we have the story of her leading the, I think, 50, 60 Chinese children away from the Japanese army, refugees, and her being faithful in the midst of that. She was an uneducated woman, had been denied by mission societies, and she traveled by herself as a single woman across the Soviet Union to go serve in China, and then was faithful to serve in the midst of a refugee crisis. Eric Little was imprisoned in a Japanese concentration camp during the war, and just how faithful he was in the midst of that to proclaim and the goodness of Christ. I got to see a documentary of just children who had been taught by him and the example that he had lived. He'd been faithful, and these children had grown up in the faith. They had seen that example. I mentioned Cambodia earlier in the gospel that went forth there, and Corrie ten Boom. These are not individuals who volunteered for their refugee work. They were placed in those camps, but just their faithfulness to serve in the midst of these troubles and crises. So that's sort of, I've covered a lot of ground and in a short period of time, and I've only hit on the subject, but I just ask, what can we do about that? What is believers in Maryville, Tennessee, far removed from this geographically, culturally, you name it, what can we do? What are some of the things that we can do to be engaged in this, to be thinking about it and go forward? I'll just open that up. It's a big question. Are there things?
There are refugees in Knoxville. She loved Tracy Picklestone when she was with me. Anyway, she works with them sometimes, I think, in the program that she's with her job. And I know Fritz and Dave were talking about doing an English class with some of them. You know, so there's like, even though it is geographically the large numbers far from us, there are still those who are, like you said, in Knoxville area, you know, in our own midst that are still in need.
Yeah.
That's sad to me that 80% have never been invited into an American home. That's
it hit me hard too. One thing I think that we really need to think about, you know, Chris was talking about today of just how these Indians who come to Christ are giving up their past. They're being, that family unit is so essential for their culture, and it's their very means of survival and a lack of a social security net and so forth. And by coming to Christ, they are really giving up all their cultural supports. These people have already lost all their cultural supports, everything that they hold dear. You know, a lot of these refugees they're living on handouts for food and water and clothing, but these were doctors, these were lawyers, these were accountants in their country. These were people who had had a level of success or prominence, and they've lost everything. And they're looking at a life in these camps, maybe without ever exiting these camps. And so all that they've held dear is gone. And, you know, I guess in some sense, that decision of those Indians coming to Christ of what are they going to lose, that's no longer a question for them. They've lost it all. what can they have? And it can be, I mean, at that point, the gospel can be made that much dearer to them, and they can cling to it. This isn't all just doom and gloom. I recently read an article of how the church in Germany seems, in some areas, seems to be undergoing a revival of all these Afghan refugees coming to faith in Christ. Isn't it amazing that a dying church that seems moribund, that seems totally dead, that the influx of migrants from a predominantly Muslim culture are coming to Christ, and they may be the source of growth and the revitalization of that church. Who's to say? The years will tell, but there can be much accomplished and much to be done for the kingdom. Anything else?
Yeah. I have a good friend that I went to school with. She actually worked under me in athletic training, but her family is a refugee family from Sudan, and like they're very they don't have a ton, but they have a house, they have nice clothes, they're pretty normal. Like you wouldn't know that they were from there. But she's told us a little bit about she was a lot younger when they came over here, but told about how she was born in the woods, and how there were a lot of times where they had to like stay outside, and they went from like place to place overnight a lot, and a little bit of the process, and just to hear that, and then like see where they are now. They're pretty, like I said, normal. And one thing I noticed about her and kind of working around her is, almost a little more than anybody else, she would kind of try to show her worth, you know, to our team, almost like she wanted to prove that she was worth having around, like she was a person just like everybody else who could work and had a purpose and stuff. And you know, that kind of struck me that maybe that was like something they dealt with as a family, that it didn't feel like where they were treated as like people who, you know, were worth anything. But like I said, it's really interesting to see like someone like them who has taken the opportunities to come into America, like I guess the right way. They're citizens, they hold jobs, and they've been successful.
Well, it's I went on this, I went to this topic with a little of a, well, not a little, a great deal of trepidation, because this has become very, very politicized, right? It's good that we're probably doing this, you know, 8, 9, 10 months after an election, rather than trying to talk about it in the midst of it, because there are big questions. There are questions. It was politicized in a great deal. I think this is an issue where we have to think, you know, about our governing authorities and what's our obligation. What's governing authorities' obligation, and which is the care of and protection of its people. But then also, what are the obligations of the church? And the church's obligations are to reach out to the world, reach out to those in need, the sojourners and the widows and the orphans, and care for them. As a society, as a government, I mean, there has to be some concern and care and taken for the safety of its people. But yet we have to see that there's this overwhelming humanitarian crisis going on as a church and responding to it. And there are no easy answers. There's no simple solutions to this problem. And it's one to go with a great deal of prayer and thought. Anything else?
I think just Mother Nature.
in Knoxville, or if you probably as a church just have to be very intentional if there are, if one of those refugees or families is in our lives, and ask, you know, what can we do as individuals in that person's life? Because I think we so often, it's so big, the numbers are so overwhelming, that maybe it's like, well, we think they're getting covered under some organization, or that get there and not maybe realizing, yeah, we could be the very ones that are in their life to invite them over, or maybe try and set up an ESL class. Where we lived in Louisville, in an apartment complex, they had a lot of refugees also there, and you'd see them walking around, and what's tough is, I mean, they, most of them didn't know English, and so I mean, you'd wave and you'd smile, and I know some people there were doing ESL classes, and so, I mean, it's so big, but then, I mean, I guess you try and just break it down in what tangible ways in your life, but I think, like you said, be prayerful. You know, I don't know if I was going to ask if you know of any, either local or even if Action does, like, is there an organization that we can support that we know does a good job with helping refugees that would be an avenue to perhaps, like, if we wanted to help with this, I don't even know some, like, where do you begin other than if you had someone in your life? So is there any organization or someone that you could say, okay, here's someone you could get behind or look up and sit, and they might have more like tangible ways of how you can get involved, or do you know of any?
I think that I looked up that Global Frontier Missions. Yeah. They're involved a bit in that. World Relief is, of course, a big one. I went to a conference last November, and apparently Chattanooga is an area where they are trying to send a bunch of refugees. There had been talk of plugging in there, so I'm already thinking like a living down Cleveland, but I think Knoxville is a place that is, there is some that is going on there too. It's interesting that you would mention Action, the agency I'm with. That's been the big thing of how do we handle this? We're very small. We haven't been engaged in that sort of work, but the needs are so big, we need to, and so we're looking at it, and it's difficult because Action is a faith-based organization. It usually takes a couple years to send missionaries. So are we going to have a bunch of people come in and they may do money for 2 years? Well, the thing about this is it's shifting. You know, at some point the route's going one way, and then one country is closing it off and they aren't allowing any more in. And so you may be all prepared to go and send people and to have a force there, and it's changed. And how do you, and you're talking about, okay, you raise money for a couple of years and then you're going to go work with people who speak Arabic. I mean, you're talking another 5 years to get a language. So it's like, well, 7 years, that's woefully insufficient when you've got 200,000 people crossing over into these lands right away. What do you do? And so how do you deal with the situation? It does seem to be daunting. I think from our organization, we are located in Uganda. So I think a lot of that thought is, well, we will focus on an area where we already have a presence, and because we can't do it all. As Chris was saying, you could live 1,000 lifetimes in Delhi and not even touch the surface for ministering there. But so you have to be wise. You have to seek counsel. You have to understand that resources are finite, and our time and so forth is, and seek to minister in the best ways possible. But it's difficult.
But you said Global Frontiers Mission would be.
I think they would be one, and of course, yeah, World Relief is sort of the big. But I mean, I think you can just search on there and go forward. With that, I will bring this to a close.